and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Featured Interview. Today we have a fabulous guest. I don't even know where he lives, but I'm sure we'll get into it. His film, Bigfoot, Path from the Beast. It's the name of the film. Justin Snyder's in the house. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So I want to start at the beginning. Like I always have to have this question. Are you a Bigfoot fan or is this just, I want to write about Bigfoot?
So really the story started when I was a little kid. I would go out and adventure on my own because we used to live at a house that had like 500 acres in my backyard, basically. So as a kid, I would just go out and go on adventures all the time. And I'd find like really weird things out in the woods, but I never like put those things together. And then about this, around the same time, you know, it was probably like 12 years old, I saw the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek, which just like started filling my imagination of, oh my gosh, this thing is real. It's out there. So then I just fell down the rabbit hole of Bigfoot.
So when you filmed this, your first location, the forest, is that your house?
So it's actually, I filmed it at different locations. It was property that I rented the property that a friend of mine knew the landowner. So I was just able to rent that and kind of film there. I knew I could film there. So I used locations I knew I could use because this is a micro budget film. So those are some things I had to keep in mind.
So I guess my question is, you kind of give me two stories here. I really thought you laid groundwork at the beginning of the story for it to go one way. And then you spent about 10, 15 minutes on that. Then you totally curveballed me for the next hour.
How
to go
so?
Back to the beginning. Is that was your plan?
Well, as far as what are you asking is my plan?
Well, did you have two stories in mind and suddenly change mid-writing, or your plan was always to give me that curveball after the first 15 minutes?
Oh, no, no. For the film, I'm just saying this is how, like, you know, how I got inspired to do the Bigfoot stuff. But for the film, it was like, you know, I fell into filmmaking. I made another movie called Black Eyed Children Let Me In. So I like, you know, the creepypasta or stuff that just freaks me out, basically. And I, you know, ever since The Legend of Boggy Creek, I was like, I need to make my own film. And that's kind of how I fell with the Bigfoot stuff. I wanted to make a really high-energy Bigfoot movie. That was the whole goal there.
No, I completely understand that. I'm just asking, when you wrote it, I mean, I don't really want to spoil it, but I guess I can at the beginning, so it doesn't matter. It's kind of like a kidnapping right at the beginning of the film.
So it's if you're involved in the Bigfoot community, it's actually some you ever heard of the missing 411 stories?
No.
Okay. So there's a famous author. He used to be a police detective out in California, and he started writing these books called the missing 411. Basically, they're about people that go missing in the woods, mostly in like public parks or state parks. So there's been theories in the Bigfoot community that these people are going missing because Bigfoot's taking them. So I was using that concept and kind of ran with my story because David Pilates, who's the author of these books. So these are real stories about real people that go missing. He also did a book about Bigfoot in state parks. So that's how people kind of draw the connection there.
Okay. That makes sense. Sorry, I missed that. Since you're on a micro-budget film, you have a lot of locations. I mean, you have a school location, a bookstore, and a house, which I do want to get in the house a little bit later. So how did you get your locations?
So I cheated the house. I shot three or four scenes in the house, and that was my house, my personal house at the time. And we just cheated some of the shots and shot some of the indoor scenes all at the same house, if that makes any sense. And
yes.
Then I rented out a cafe. They had a room that you could rent out for business meetings. And I asked the owner, hey, look, I'm working on this movie. Can I rent the place out? And he actually cut me a really good deal. It's a great place. I'm really happy with, what they did there and how, you know, they allowed me to do all the filming and stuff. It just worked out perfectly. And then the wood scenes, you know, most of all the same location. And that's when I wrote the script that was in my mind that if I keep it in the woods, I can keep the budget down low because that's easy to kind of manipulate and stuff.
Now, the house is covered in beer cans, and I mean covered. So is that pool.
It's funny that that pool is up and operating now. But when we shot that scene, that was how that pool was when me and my wife bought the house. It had like fish and turtles in it. And I was like, oh, this is perfect. It was just perfect for the story. So, yeah, I just used that, took that to my advantage. And then my wife was not so happy about all those beer cans and stuff that was all out through the house. And basically what I was doing was I was collecting as many cans as I could, because knowing to shoot the scene and had the scene already like in my head how it's going to look. So, you know, a lot of it wasn't really beer cans. It was just cans in general. I just smushed as much as possible because, you know, avoid any logos being seen or brands being seen. And just as many cans as I could collect as possible.
Hold on. Let's back this up. You bought a house.
Yes.
And you pretty much trash the house as soon as you get it just to film your movie?
No. No, that's a great story, though. No. So, you know, I set the setup exactly how I pictured it in my head with all those cans and stuff. And it's funny because we filmed those scenes there and we made some errors and actually had to go back and figure out how to set it up and trash it all over again. And the house was when we bought it was a foreclosure, and this is like right when I was starting to make the movie. So when we bought the house, the pool was already destroyed. So I just used that to my advantage when I was doing the story. I was like, "Oh, it looks great. It's kind of like this depressing feel." So it was like perfect for that scene.
Well, I'm just wondering, how did your wife react to walking into a scene just covered in cans?
Oh, she was not happy. I told her I'd clean it up, so that was the only way I was able to do that.
Okay. So the house, since you just told me, the house is, I'm sure, looking 100 times
better. Oh, yeah, yeah. The house does not look like that. And that, you know, that was, you know, 2 or 3 hours of us setting up the scene and then 2 and 3 hours of us breaking it down and cleaning the house.
Okay. These are things I like to know. Yeah. Your lead actor goes through a transformation at one point and has a pretty healthy beard.
Thank you.
Now, was the beard filmed first or second?
The beard was filmed first.
So was he happy to get it off?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I'm the actor in this film, right?
I know that.
All right. I grew out everything, and I had to keep this consistent long hair and beard for like the next 3 years, just to, whenever I was ready to go and shoot a scene, we had to be ready to go and shoot a scene. Because a lot of the taking advantage and like making sure things line up with other actors was a big task to overcome. Because, you know, I'm not working with professional actors here. I'm working with, you know, whoever's available usually. And so it was like that, coordinating with my DP, it was like a lot of juggling. So it took a long time to actually film this.
So now hang on. You had a beard for 3 years. So you filmed this over 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Beard and long hair. And then the beginning of the film where the character is completely clean shaved.
Yes.
We shot some scenes in the woods. We made sure we got everything. We got some B-roll. I went to the barbershop, got everything cut and shaved, came back, and then shot the beginning of the film.
So how do you plan to shoot a film over 3 years? Like, how does that work?
It's just, like I said, you got to take advantage of opportunities that come up, you know, working with the script and kind of like figuring out, okay, maybe we can't do this, but we can do this, right? So just making sure there's available actors, you know, who do I want to play these roles? And then finding the time for everyone, because like I said, nobody's really getting paid on this project. So when I have, you know, crew there, I got to make sure that I can get as many people available as possible. When I'm getting actors there, I got to make sure their time, you know, lines up with everything. So it's just like a juggling act, basically. And, you know, a lot of it was prepping stuff and just making sure we were ready to roll.
Now, in shooting over 3 years, I mean, do you have a lot of color corrections to do when you were in the film? Because I mean, you're going to have different lighting all the time, I would think.
My DP was really good. He was really good. He helped Zach Bowman's his name. He helped me significantly on this film, and he's an editor for a living, so he knew exactly what he was doing. And like, you know, as far as filming aspect of things, especially on the micro budget side, you know, it's hard to make movies, right? You probably know that from everyone that you talk to. So sometimes an audience will forgive a shot. So as long as your audio is good, and as long as you know you're telling a good story or a compelling story, some of those things you can get away with so much, you know.
So I just got to go back. I mean, you spent 3 years filming. Were you filming in different towns at this time, or was it always the same place?
It was throughout. So I'm from the Northern Virginia area. Most of this is shot throughout Northern Virginia. I don't think we went outside of Virginia, but yeah, it'd be different locations. You know, I'd have to rent I rented the cafe, and then I also rented a large room to have we have like a Finding Bigfoot mock up kind of thing going on in the film. So I had to rent that out, and I had to get as many people as I could. That was hard, finding as many extras as I could to be just in this scene. So yeah.
I want to actually get ahead of my next topic. I want to discuss the Finding Bigfoot scene.
Go for it.
Now, I was assuming while you watched the film, the Bigfoot people aren't too helpful to this person and basically tell them to get lost.
Yes.
Now, I thought the Bigfoot community, just from the films I've seen on Finding Bigfoot and having Bigfoot in them, that they would be a little more receptive to him. Or is this an experience you've read about?
So I'm not going to like hate on the Bigfoot community, because I feel like I'm a part of it at this point, but you get a lot of people who have different opinions, and people are just not willing to, you know, give up on those opinions. I mean, Finding Bigfoot's the perfect example. That those four cast members, they're not all friends, you know. Two of them get along and that's it, you know. If you look at them and follow their separate lives, they're all going their own way except for two of them. And so I think you get a lot of egos going on and a lot of, like I said, opinions. And the Bigfoot community, I feel like, is a little bit of the older generation. So I feel like it's, you know, not the, you know, pick on the older, but it's like people kind of stuck in their ways kind of thing. If that makes any sense.
It does.
Yeah.
Where did you find your Bigfoot costumes?
I designed and made them myself. So I pieced together, like, I'd buy a gorilla suit here, a werewolf suit here. And then for the face, I wanted them to look different than anything else you would see on a movie or, you know, from a costume. So I went out and bought the whole arm stand for the face, to design the face. I made it out of silicone. I had to learn how to do all that. So that was a fun process. And then I designed the feet to fit over just the actor's shoes, which was really cool. And then, that's how I ran with it. And then, you know, I would just add a little touch to it, fur, gluing leaves on it, stuff like that to simulate how I would think a Bigfoot would look.
How long did it take you to learn all this? I mean, that's a lot of work.
It probably took me, I would say, at least 6 months to kind of get it figured out. And I was like, my thought process was like, if it doesn't come out perfect, at least you can put some hair on it. Well, we don't want to show the creature as much in the film anyways, you know. And it really, I think, you know, some of the costumes look a little not so great, but they're, you know, one or two of them I feel like really hit, and I like them a lot. And you know, it's going to help me in the future if I decide to do something else. It's another skill set I just learned. And that's what you have to do when you make micro budget films. You know, you got to wear many hats and just know how to do many things.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. That would bring me a question. You're a micro budget film. You've done this over 3 years. How is catering and feeding your crew then?
That's super important. And the biggest problem it was, and I spend a lot of money on that. The biggest problem was dealing with the whole, when we were doing the Finding Bigfoot mock-up scene, because I would had like, you know, what, 30 people on set?
Yeah.
More than that. It was hard to juggle because we're only using local restaurants, and then you had somebody who had a, a food allergy or had to deal with that. So that's the hardest thing when you're catering food. So that's why I try to work with people I know, and that way you build a relationship and you don't step on people's feet. And then you're, oh, okay. Like my DP, I know he has condition as well, but I know, okay, he likes pizza. He likes pizza from this certain shop. So we're going to get pizza from this certain shop. My DP, I got to keep happy. So I'm going to make sure mm-hmm. he's happy, you know? But like I said, most of the cast were friends or people I've worked with in the past. So I had that relationship prior to.
Do you find that independent filmmaking gives you an adrenaline rush, or is it just something inside you that gives you a drive? You have to do this.
It must be something, because there's days where it can be depressing. I'll give you a perfect example. So when we were filming Everything in the Woods, I blocked off a whole week because I work a full-time job. I blocked off a full week. You know, I got everyone figured out as far as the cast and crew. So I had everything scheduled. My DP took off a whole week from his job. So we had this whole week blocked off to film Everything in the Woods, all the meaty stuff that's for the film, right? The first day was the day that I had the most crew members there. So people to help out, production assistants, all that jazz. So, you know, I had a lot of people. So I was like, let's get all the like really hard scenes or the really intense dialogue scenes out of the way. So, you know, an actor I worked with my previous film was playing a character in this film as well. And he started having problems with the lines. And I was like, okay, it's all good. It's all good. And we just mustered through the day and we weren't getting a whole lot done. And by the end of the day, he started having a little bit of a mental breakdown. And, you know, I'm trying to do my best just to be a friend and trying to like encourage him, saying, hey, look, it's okay. What we have right now, we can still work with. And then later that day, I got my car stuck in the mud. So it's my car stuck in the mud in the middle of the field. One of my actors is having this mental breakdown. And the person that we were renting the location from was upset that I got the car stuck. So I had to deal with that too. So then, you know, I had to cut the whole day short because of the car being stuck. And then that actor, just not able to do the scene. And then the next day the actor completely blew me off, just totally dipped out of the whole project, to deal with some mental anxiety. So I had to find a new actor. And I was like, at that point I was just kind of like, are we going to even be able to get this done this week? We just wasted a whole day shooting and we can't use any of it because I got to replace the actor.
So how did you find your other actor then? Can't leave me hanging.
So there's an actor, the character Kai in the film, really, really pretty lady. Her name's Kayla Cooper, and super, super nice lady. She was actually my dad's neighbor. My dad, I called my dad to tell him what was going on, and he's like, oh, I got somebody perfect. And he just, he pulled her up and said, she's good, she's good. And we're like, you know what? We don't really have a choice. We'll just work around it. So it was her first time acting and everything. And she did a really good job, I think. And you know, it was tough cause like she didn't have time to prepare or memorize lines. We actually had to cut some stuff out of that character. But what we got with the overall product, I think, is still pretty good.
Now, when you're on a micro-budget film, I mean, and obviously you have a script, do you let them ad-lib your script and just go, because you're – I mean, you have to be under very heavy time constraints.
So this should vary probably with actors and with talent. So if I'm dealing with I'll give you a perfect example. We have a character in our story named David Palmer. And Dave Palmer, and it was played by an older gentleman who's a seasoned actor, right? When directing him, he knew all of his lines and he understood the character. So it varies with your talent, because sometimes you get actors who only know how to do improv, and then you get some actors who maybe not experienced it at all, and you kind of have to like pull the character out of them. Hey, don't have to remember these lines verbatim. I just want you to play this character exactly how you feel this character should be. So those things kind of come into play. So it all varies, really, to be honest with you.
Okay, but how does that make you feel as a director? You're like, you've written this line to go a certain way, so you kind of have to go to them, hey, I need that line of dialogue. Everything else before it, you can play with.
So this is what I kind of imagine. When you're a writer, and then you write a script a certain way, and then a director gets hold of it, and that director wants it to go a certain way, and then your editor gets a hold of it, and then you get a completely different product. So the film gets made three times, no matter what, right? It gets written, directed, and then edited. So, even if I wrote it a certain way, I might not have the talent for that, or I might not have the time for that. So as a director, I have to make decisions, right? As long as I know the story can go along and it's making sense sometimes, especially on a micro budget, that's all I can really do. It's no longer like in my control right there. And then, in post, in the editor room, you might find out, okay, we can't even use this scene because we had an error here, or there was something going on with the sound, so this is not even a usable scene. Those things happen.
Now, how do you find the writing process for a micro budget? I mean, obviously you have to say, I can't use that. Nope, can't use that. So how does that work in your head?
So some people, some writers, screenwriters, they like to write, their story to its fullest, where I'm like, if you're making micro budget films, you just have to write with what you've got. And there's also a thing out there called a scriptment. Basically, it's just instead of writing dialogue, you would write, and this is more for micro budget film and actors or talent that you know well that can handle these scenes. It's basically you just write the overall events that's supposed to take place and the locations, and then you let your actors deliver the performances however they perceive their character. So there's no actually written dialogue, right? And if you ever listen to Alex Fiore from Indie Film Hustle, that's his model of filmmaking. So more run and gun filmmaking, where you just let the talent kind of carry the story. So that's I think a good way to think about it too. And then also, like I said, you've got to utilize what you have. So I knew I could get a wooded location relatively easy. So let's keep most of the story in the woods. And then, every time you write something, you have to take in consideration the price of that and the time consumption of that. And how it draws in the story as well. Cause the worst thing you want to do is make a boring movie. And that was a concern of mine. You want to make sure that you can carry the audience with you throughout the entire story. You got to add some excitement in there, right off the bat to keep the attention on your film. So those are some things I think you have to take into consideration.
Oh, one thing to go back, I did forget to ask about, where's your tent come from, and do you like camping?
Wait, I use a tent.
You do use a tent. You have a tent when he comes out. And they're in the tent looking at the stars, right, in the first 15 minutes.
Oh, yeah. You're absolutely right in the beginning. That's an old tent I just have in the house. I think it's a prop from my first film. So it's just been something I've been keeping. And no, I'm not a really big camper guy. I grew up hunting and stuff, but I'm not really a big camper.
Fair enough. Continuing on, how is casting for you as a micro director? You don't really have a lot of money in the film.
No. And, depending on the talent, you can hire somebody from SAG, but then you have to go through the whole paperwork. So really the best option is to go non-union. And basically what I would do, depending on the talent and their resume, I would pay them like $80 a day. So I did pay some of my talent. I hired one person that had a rep. So I had to pay them and the rep. For me, I was trying to just find friends or people I've worked with before that I know would show up on a set and be ready to go. So that's mainly what I did. And I took that in consideration when I was writing the story. Like, okay, the guy that plays our character, Hank, Matt Pulling, I knew he would show up any day, wherever, whenever I needed him. So, that's why he's my second main character, so.
How'd you get on Tubi, by the way?
I went through a streaming, a distribution platform called Film Hub. I don't know if you ever heard of it.
I do. Okay. I have.
So Film Hub has different, I guess, contracts or different deals with these streaming platforms, and Tubi is one of those platforms they utilize.
Will you, in the future, look at other movie monsters to go through, or are you going to go back to Bigfoot, or you're like, nope, I'm done with this, I'm going to do something totally different?
So I feel like this movie was a little bit pretentious of me. after, you know, I don't want to waste another 3 years filming another Bigfoot movie. And, you know, I took a kind of more serious tone to Bigfoot in this film, where I think moving forward, I'm probably going to be a little bit more cheeky with it, I guess you could say. I do want to do, because I have the costumes and I have, you know, the built-in kind of audience now, because I made this first one, and it all plays into each other, you know. If I keep making cryptid-based movies, you know, I can just build that resume with those, right? So right now I'm actually in the works with getting some writers to write a Mothman Ooh. Found footage style film is the plan. And then I plan on doing a Mothman, Bigfoot, Dogman crossover film.
Well, that sounds very exciting.
Yeah, man. I'm writing the Dogman, Bigfoot, and Mothman crossover story. And yeah.
Do you feel COVID has hurt your film a lot because you couldn't tour it, you couldn't take it to film festivals?
So initially I thought it would help it, because I thought, oh, I need to get this kind of – I kind of rushed it over the summer this year to get it finished, because I'm like, people are at home, people are bored, you can't really do anything, you're probably going to watch TV, so let me try to get it out there on these platforms so that, you know, I can get it going, right? But I learned kind of the hard way. Right now, horror films are on the decline. It seems like, well, just talking with different distributors, they're looking for more positive content that seems to be on the upcline because of COVID. I guess people are just tired of the gloom and loom, so they want to see something more happy. So I was seeing that. And then I make a decent amount of sales when I go to these Bigfoot conventions. I was actually able to do one in July of 2019, because Tennessee has some relaxed rules about the COVID. So I went to the Smoky Mountain Bigfoot Conference and was able to have a booth there and sell the film. But the problem is, with the COVID, you actually had a really low turnout. That, and I had to be extra safe because I don't want to get sick and I don't want to get my family sick. So yeah, I do feel like the COVID thing kind of messed me up with the conventions. But as far as, you know, streaming and being on these platforms, I feel like it should have kind of helped it a bit.
Fair enough. Are you ready for some fun questions?
Yes, sir. Let's go.
Okay, because first time on my show, your favorite film, please.
It's Rocky, the very first Rocky movie.
There's nothing wrong with Rocky.
No.
One film you should have seen and never have.
Oh, that's a good one. Oh, man. That's a loaded question.
No, it's not.
Yeah. One film I should have seen. You know what? Scarface. I own it. Never seen it.
one of those sitting on the shelf films.
It's actually Scarface and then The Godfather. There's the two that I own and I just haven't put them in yet. Yep.
Okay. This may be a film you always tell people to watch and they've never heard of.
Lake Mungo. Have you ever heard of that one?
No, I've never heard of it. So now you got another guy to watch it.
So I watch a lot of horror films. That's my go-to. And I don't really get scared, but Lake Mungo is that one movie. It's not scary, but it's like one of those movies at the end, you just get the chills, like the hairs in the back of your neck just stands up. And it's just a well-shot and well-thought-out film. It's a mockery style film, not giving too much away, just about a girl that passes away and it has to do a little bit with her ghost. And they like tell you that right in the beginning of the film, but it just, the story is like sad. And at the same time, it's super creepy and just super eerie. If you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. And I think it's actually streaming on Tubi right now.
Now, before I let you go, we know your film's available on Tubi. Is there anywhere else? Maybe people want to buy a DVD or poster or something.
Yeah, if you're interested in a DVD, you can go to eBay and search it up, Bigfoot Path of the Beast. I also have a website, pathofthebeast.com. It's on Tubi, Amazon Prime. So if you're a Prime member, you can stream it for free. I asked if anybody does watch it, just please leave me a review on International Movie Database. It helps me out significantly.
Thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate it.